Welcome to the Cancer Pod. In this episode, we're talking with Dr. Amy Rothenberg, naturopathic physician, author, advocate, teacher, and cancer survivor. She has a new book out, You Finished Treatment, Now What? A Field Guide for Cancer Survivors. So stay tuned for some laughter, some lessons, and ultimately, some inspiration.
I'm Dr. Tina Kayser, and as Leah likes to say, I'm the sciencey one.
And I'm Dr. Leah Sherman, and I'm the cancer insider.
And we're two naturopathic doctors who practice integrative cancer care.
But we're not your doctors.
This is for education, entertainment, and informational purposes only.
Do not apply any of this information without first speaking to your doctor.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast by the hosts and their guests are solely their own.
Welcome to the Cancer Pod. Hey, Tina.
Hi, Leah. How goes it today?
Don't you know what today is?
Yes.
It's our anniversary.
Happy anniversary, honey.
Yeah, darling, happy anniversary. We got each other an interview.
We did. We're going to celebrate.
This is our first interview.
Yep.
Yeah.
We're celebrating our 1 year anniversary. And I think this is our 40-something-ish episode.
Yeah, I've lost count. But because there's so many. But yeah, we're testing out a new format for the new fiscal year. I don't know what you call this, but for our
you need to have some kind of fiscal movement to have a fiscal year. We don't have any. We don't have fiscals.
We're fisk-free.
We're fiscal-less.
Anyways, what makes it super exciting is that we do have an interview today.
Yeah. So give us feedback. I'm going to say it right out of the gates instead of waiting to the end. Give us feedback. Tell us what you like and tell us if this is something you want us to do a lot more of. Today we have Dr. Amy Rothenberg, who's a naturopathic physician. She's an author. She's a lecturer. She's a homeopath. She is a powerhouse in our profession. Everyone within naturopathic medicine knows who Amy is. She was instrumental in getting naturopathic physicians licensed in the state of Massachusetts. Our latest conquest in our licensure efforts across the nation. So Amy is joining us today, and she's also a survivor of cancer. And we're going to talk to her today about the ins and outs of that, what it's like to be a naturopathic physician who then goes on to get cancer. And that was back in 2014. So we're going to talk about how you're doing and a book. There is a book coming out. So we're going to talk about that a little bit too. So Amy, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me and happy anniversary. And for those of you who are listening to this because you know me and I've shared this link with you, you need to go and check out the previous episodes. They are so interesting and filled with so much actionable information. And these two doctors, Leah and Tina, are very funny and personable and super useful information. So please go back and listen to previously recorded podcasts.
Well, thanks for that endorsement.
Yeah, thank you.
It means a lot coming from you, to be perfectly honest. I mean, you know, you are a mover and a shaker. And, you know, we all do this for the same reason, we naturopathic physicians. And we ultimately just want to help people, you know, and there's no other net goal. We didn't become naturopathic physicians to become famous, that's for sure. So we're all on the same page.
I want to thank you for acknowledging the legislative work. I will also add that Wisconsin is now licensed. They came in after us in the last couple of years. So we're super excited about Wisconsin now licenses naturopathic doctors.
I have to say, I didn't even know that.
I didn't either. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Okay. So how long? Let me just ask you this. I'm going to get a few technicals out of the way. You've been a naturopathic physician for how long?
Since 1986, I graduated. I graduated on a Saturday night from naturopathic school, and on Sunday afternoon, I got married.
Oh, wow.
And I'm still with that same naturopathic doctor, husband of mine, Dr. Paul Herskew, who's been very instrumental in a lot of things within our profession. But in terms of me, he was basically, I would consider him a one-man research phenom who did a lot of work when I was sick to help us understand kind of what was going on and what would be the best treatment plans going forward. And I'm forever grateful for that.
Yeah. So maybe just starting with a brief synopsis, just so people who don't know you, become familiar with what ultimately, for better and worse, resulted in a lot of street cred within cancer care. And that was your own experience.
You bet. Yes. And I've told this story many times. So those of you who have heard it before, I'm sorry. I am a person who really has lived a very healthy lifestyle my whole life. I was early on in, you know, as a teenager, I was vegetarian. I was an avid exerciser. I never abused my body with regard to alcohol or drugs. I always had wonderful supportive community, friends, family, etc. So that kind of continued. I really was very blessed with good health and vitality through my 20s, through my 30s, through my 40s, through the birth and raising of three wonderful children who are now all grown up and doing good things in the world in their own right. And then at 54, I found a lump in my breast a couple months after a normal mammogram. I had been tested previously for the BRCA mutation, which is a mutation that makes people more likely to develop breast and or ovarian cancer. I had tested negative for it and always felt a kind of sigh of relief when I tested negative. I kept testing because they kept telling me the test keeps getting better. When I found the lump in my breast, I knew it was not good because I had never had a lump in my breast before. I just had a bad feeling about it. And it had just popped up literally overnight. It was January 1st, New Year's Day, 2014. The night before, my husband and I, avid ballroom dancers, had been out dancing till 4 in the morning. I don't think I sat down for one dance. Felt at the top of my game, looked great, you know, clear mind, open heart. I was diagnosed. The next day I went in and a couple of days later, I was diagnosed with early breast cancer. And they said to me, well, you know, you should have a lumpectomy and a little radiation and you'll be fine. And I said to them, actually, we're going to remove both breasts because my sister who had disease as well, several times had breast cancer and ovarian cancer, had also tested negative. And I said to the people, my care at excellent state-of-the-art care at Mass General in Boston, a big teaching hospital, I said to them, you know, we might not have that gene, but we clearly have something. And I'm not going to stand here and go through this again in a couple of years. We're going to remove both breasts. We're going to be aggressive in our conventional medical treatments, which we did. And halfway through my treatment, they said, you know, you might want to get tested again. Just maybe the test has gotten a little better for your family, what your family might carry. So I did. And I turned out to be positive for the BRCA mutation, which basically for me meant just sort of bad timing. If I tested again, you know, I would have proactively removed my breasts and my ovaries. But anyway, I went through treatment and Dr. Kayser was a very helpful part of my naturopathic doctor team that I worked with alongside my conventional care to help enhance the efficacy of conventional care and prevent side effects and address side effects that arose and to mop up afterward. Thank you for all your help and being available to me. But honestly, they said to me, I think I finished my care for breast cancer in June. I had 4 rounds of chemo. I had 28 radiation shots to my chest wall because there was a little bit of lymphovascular invasion of the tumor itself, even though it was early stage and grading. I wanted to be that person who, if I ever got cancer again and I was looking back, I would be able to say I did everything in my power to be healthy and to regain my health. So no stone unturned. We did all those treatments, finished in June or maybe July. And they said, well, why don't you wait, you know, 6 months or a year till you kind of recover from everything from the breast cancer, and then we will prophylactically remove your ovaries. And I, at that point, said, look, it's been a pretty crappy year. I don't want to put this all into the next year. Let's just wait till my hematocrit hits 36, because I was pretty anemic after cancer treatment for the breast cancer. And then let's go after my ovaries. So we did that. It was like literally 3.5 weeks later after I finished my last radiation treatment. I went in for surgery to have my ovaries removed, and it was going to be laparoscopic, and it was supposed to be an hour, you know, and a half surgery. I woke up and I saw the clock, and it was like 8 hours later. I thought, this can't possibly be good. There was cancer on both ovaries. Lucky me. A few years back, my sister had gone through ovarian cancer. And at that time, the treatment for it was stage one ovarian cancer. The treatment for that was basically a complete hysterectomy and no other care. That was the treatment. Mm-hmm. For me, the treatment had changed. And what was recommended was 12 more rounds of chemo, different chemo from the breast cancer. So I had 12 more rounds of chemo that year, quite a year. And my last chemo was January 2nd, 2015. So it was really bookend, you know, this year. But I made a commitment to Paul that last chemo. I said, honey, next year, 6 months from today, let's try to do a triathlon. I had never done a triathlon before. And I thought, I just need something that will really hone my commitment to exercise, bump it up a little bit. I've always been an avid exerciser, but bump it up a little bit and give me something to look forward to. Let's make it a big family event. We'll invite the kids, we'll invite the siblings, the partners, the nieces and nephews, all that. So we had a big family triathlon. I did the whole thing myself. They all worked in teams, but I did the whole thing myself. I did actually pretty well. And I felt like that for me was my taking back some control and taking back some self-agency around my health. I did a lot of other things. We can talk about all many things, many of which, of course, I write about in my book. You guys pontificate on, you know, so eloquently all the time. I basically do all of it. I would never ask a cancer patient of mine to do everything that I do. It's too much. I know it's too much, but I'm motivated. I'm blessed with a sunny disposition and a lot of energy. I think just came through genetically. So there we have it. That's my story. And I, you know, I have felt very well. People said, well, you must have some symptoms left over. And I don't. I mean, I don't want to jinx myself, knocking on wood over here, but I really feel very well. And I don't think that every person who's been through cancer will feel this well, no matter what they do. But I do think that most any person who's been through cancer, whether they continue to have cancer, so many, many people now, due to effective conventional treatment, live years and of productive, happy enough lives. Most of us can feel better than we feel today by taking some pretty basic steps in the direction toward health and leaving on the side of the road those things that we know work against good health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm going to vouch for the fact that you have a level of energy that most people just don't have. I mean, you really do have a tremendous amount of energy and, of course, attitude and optimism. And like you said, a good disposition, which is a blessing as far as the way your neurotransmitters are set up. And kudos to you for taking care of yourself, because that, of course, is icing on the cake.
Yeah.
But you are a powerhouse and everyone knows that.
But I also want to insert here that my entire career, I have lived in semi-retirement. In other words, the first 2 years, Paul and I worked 6 days a week, half a day on Sunday, long days. And the Sunday was devoted to the treatment of large animals. We were in Omaha, Nebraska. We never took any money for that. It was just more sort of recommendations, suggestions. And we worked very, very hard. Then I had my first kid and I knew right away I wanted to be home. I wanted to raise my kids. I didn't want to have them in full-time daycare, although many people do and it works out fine. That wasn't for me. I had 3 kids in 3.5 years and I threw my arms up to the universe. What I often call total surrender to the path of motherhood. I would work 1 day a week seeing patients when Paul would stay home. I used to call that my day off because it was much easier to go to work. And then when the last one started kindergarten, I started working 2 and sometimes 3 days a week. And I've never worked more than that since then. I mean, the other times I also do some writing, I just teaching and all of that. And it does add up, but I'm not full-time seeing patients. And I like to say that aloud because I think I don't want people to feel disempowered. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. Yeah, I do a lot, but I also have been lucky to have other work that through teaching, where we earned a fair amount of our income. So I wasn't dependent on seeing patients 24/7. I also graduated from naturopathic medical school with no debt because it was much cheaper then. And that's not true for a lot of practicing naturopathic doctors now who need to work more. So all things, you know, just full disclosure. I have a lot of energy and time to do a bunch of stuff because I'm not seeing patients 40, 50, 60 hours a week.
So you have a lot of you time, which a lot... That's not typical, you know, and especially I noticed with, you know, my patients with breast cancer and ovarian cancer, they're very much like bad at giving themselves me time.
Yeah. I think that's true for women in general.
And those kind of go hand in hand, but yeah, I mean, it really is this gift that you are able to have time for yourself.
Right.
And to fit that in.
One of the jobs that I feel I have as a naturopathic doctor when I'm working with a patient, I feel like one of the jobs I have is to bring up in our conversation, you know, what are the biggest stressors in your life? And are there any of them that you can get out of or sidestep or let go of? Sometimes it's related to a job. Sometimes it's a stressful friend. Sometimes it's a something in the living situation. Sometimes it's something that's kind of niggling and not that big, and it's low-hanging fruit. Like I had a patient recently who doesn't have air conditioning in her car. Okay, well, you know, like you're able to drive around 50 miles an hour. It doesn't have a big deal. But in the Northeast, in the hot, humid summer, it actually is a big deal. It causes a tremendous amount of stress. And she didn't have enough money to get it fixed, or didn't feel she did. And I just talked to her about it. It's like, this is really stressing you out. I think this is something you can maybe work on. And so just having that conversation about what are the biggest stressors? Are there any that there's any wiggle room around? And if you just leave all that on one side and you shift to the other side, it's like, okay, you can't get rid of that stress. What are you doing on a daily basis to help let off steam? And of course, this is where we get into things like exercise, mindfulness, meditation, fun and joy with people that you love or on your own or in nature, whatever. And so just really bringing it down, getting a little bit away from what is happening biochemically. You know, so a lot of people are like, what supplements should I take? What herbs should I take? Super important stuff. And we always cover that information as well. But really tacking it down to how stress impacts the neurotransmitters, impacts immune function. And we're all like 100, everybody, not just cancer survivors, we're 100% dependent on our immune system. And if we're doing things on a daily basis that are impacting the efficacy and the capacity for the immune system, look, that's a leverage point for us. And I think that in conventional medicine, there's not time in the average length of visit to have these kinds of conversations with patients. My oncologists have never asked me about my emotional self, my stress level, what I do to relax. That's just, and I've worked with the best in the world. So I don't blame them. They're on a tight schedule. It's a different paradigm. It's a different philosophy of healing, but I certainly am not going to leave that out with my people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think they're afraid to ask because they literally don't have the time for your answer. Not you, but anyone's answer. They don't have the time to listen to a legitimate answer.
100%.
And it's so what's interesting, and we should talk about this, is, you know, you did a lot, like you said, you were at Mass General working with some of the best doctors in the country, if not the world, and talking to the oncologists. So, and that's one of the things that you talk about in your book is how to talk to the oncologist. So the oncologist listens and listen. So the, how does that chapter go? Something and listen when they speak or something.
So your oncologists talk. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's lifted with attribution to a wonderful book called How to Talk So Your Kids Listen and Listen So Your Kids Talk by two wonderful women, Maeslisch and Farber. And I mean, that was kind of my parenting Bible. But I felt it immediately when I got into the oncology, you know, in the patient chair, you know, somebody who was a very generous person blurbed my book, Linda Bornstein, who's a radiation oncologist. And she said, you know, Dr. Rothenberg sees this topic from both sides of the Johnny, which I had never heard that expression, but I thought it was terrific. As soon as I sat for 5 minutes in this patient chair, I was like, these people don't know how to listen. That all they did was interrupt me. In fact, there are some interesting studies on conventional medicine, not necessarily related to oncology, but that basically the amount of time before a patient is interrupted is 11 seconds.
Oh my gosh.
You can't say that much in 11 seconds. I mean, I could say a lot, talk kind of fast. No, but you can't say too much in 11 seconds. And I don't blame that world. You know, I went there for what they could do and they could offer me, and they did an excellent job. And I'm alive, I believe, because of conventional medicine alongside naturopathic care. So I think the key points that I will share with patients, if they're early on in the journey with a cancer diagnosis, is like, bring somebody with you. A number one thing, you cannot go this alone. You should not go this alone. If you are alone, some people are more alone in life by choice, or that's just how it happened. They have people. Most every hospital will have oncology social workers who can come with you to a visit, especially the early visits where you're basically drinking out of a fire hose. It's information is coming at you. Choices, information, side effects, sign here. It's just too much to take in while you're also managing what for most people is a moment of overwhelm, is a moment of terror and fright and just unknowing things that are can be very scary. And any of you survivors listening, I'm sure you can remember when you first got the bad news. You know, it's sort of like your whole world cracks open and you have to go into immediate action, which is very difficult to do when your whole world is cracked open. So bring somebody with you. spend 2 minutes thinking about what is the best way that I learn. How do I take in information best? I'm a very auditory learner. So I asked all my providers if I could record our sessions. Some said no. I think it's a liability thing. Many said yes, which is good. And I did listen back, which was helpful. And then I think right from the beginning and all through a cancer, journey, although I'm not sure I love that word, lifetime, you know, survivorship, et cetera, keep things organized, whether it's in a notebook and you print things out in 3-hole punch, like I started, and then halfway through things, it's been many years now, thank goodness, I shifted to all digital. I have files, my lab works here, and of course, we can access portals that can be so helpful. Keep things organized and keep a 1-page synopsis of your story so that if you're seeing a new provider for whatever, you can hand them the 1-page synopsis. And then learn how to come to a visit with your questions written out and have them handy or have them on your phone or whatever device you use. And be sure to tell your provider, I have some questions to ask that I want to be sure we get to before our visit's over. Put that out at the beginning and then do it. I think can be very helpful.
I think doing that in real time, like as you have questions, and it might be 3 weeks between your visits, jotting them down in real time is very useful because you think you're going to remember because it's so impactful at that moment. And then you draw a blank when the doc walks in. And so doing it in real time and just collecting those questions, I think can be helpful.
Totally. And I think, you know, for many people in treatment or survivors, they're caught in a limbo between utter thankfulness for being alive and then literally terror about recurrence. And it's paralyzing. It's paralyzing. I mean, figuratively. And so people become very educated, competent, capable individuals, and everybody else too, can become like they don't even present themselves in a way that is authentic to who they are. And they lose their capacity to present a cogent question, et cetera. Not everybody, everybody's different. But I think that that's part of what's happening is that people's emotions get in the way of their minds, very acceptable and common. And then they don't get the information that they want or need. And they leave and they're like, oh, I should have asked them, you know, about this or that, whether it's a side effect or whether it's something about fertility or something about not enjoying sex anymore. I mean, there's a lot out there that happens for survivors that is, if they've survived the cancer, that's considered a win. And it is, but if they don't feel well and their energy is poor and they have brain fog or lymphedema or peripheral neuropathy or fill in the blank, it's a quality of life issue. And I feel like with naturopathic medicine, we can impact quality of life as well as health, as well as health outcomes. So that's why every survivor, if they can, should try to access a naturopathic doctor or somebody who works in the integrative cancer space to help them to have a better quality of life and better health outcomes.
That's a great segue for a question that I have for you. So you were at Mass General. Were they familiar with naturopathic medicine? Was there integrative care available in whatever realm that they consider integrative care?
I would say that I was treated with a lot of respect. People kind of knew what naturopathic medicine was. This was 2014. We were not licensed in the state until 2017. And in fact, I received naturopathic license doctor number 1 in June of 2022. It took 5 years after the governor signed the bill before we were able to apply for licenses. So we don't have to talk about that. That was aggravating. But people knew what naturopathic medicine was, I would say. And I came in, I had my 1-pager about my, you know, history of present illness. I just presented it. I also had my 2nd page of, and here's all the things that I'm doing to help enhance efficacy, prevent side effects, address side effects, all my supplements, all my exercise routine, my mindfulness stuff, things related to my diet, special foods I was eating. I laid it all out for them. So, and I am, as we already determined, you know, energetic and upbeat. And I presented it always, you know, with a lot of, you guys are saving my life. And here's some other stuff I'm doing in that context. When I got to the ovarian cancer part, I had an amazing doctor, A.K. Goodman, who I can't say enough good things about, who is herself a licensed acupuncturist, even though she's a GYN oncology surgeon who volunteers a lot of her time teaching surgery, GYN surgeries in Bangladesh. So she's doing all the good work in the world. She's just always thrilled. And I work with the head of clinical trials there, Richard Penson. they oftentimes spend time asking me what else is new in from our perspective. What else are we thinking about and doing? Dr. Penson blurred my book. So did Dr. Lindsay Rockwell at the cancer center in my hometown. So I feel like there was openness, and they do have integrative medicine options, but they could do more. So in other words, you can get Reiki, you can get a massage, you can get a nutrition, somebody working with basics of nutrition, but they could do a lot more and they know it. And I think many cancer centers now realize patients want this. We know over 70% of individuals in America going through cancer treatment are using some kind of integrative medicine, natural medicine things, whether it's melatonin to sleep or curcumin for anti-inflammatory or acupuncture for lymphedema, you know, et cetera. So it's not like people have their head in the sand, but it's hard to know how to best integrate it. Not every cancer patient is looking for it or wanting it. Many are. I have no complaints about the way I was treated vis-a-vis my background. And I feel like there is so much ground for an opportunity for collaboration. There really is. And many of these providers send me patients. So they understand that they don't have the time or the expertise in this area. And I send them patients, of course, all the time. You know, I can't say enough about my breast surgeon. I've sent her, you know, like I'm a super referrer, you know, people who need breast surgery for cancer. So, you know, it goes both ways. And I feel that it's exciting. It's an exciting moment.
Do you find that they're referring patients to you because you're Amy Rothenberg or because you're a naturopathic physician? In other words, have these people grown to know you personally well enough that they trust you and now thus there's a referral? I mean, I feel like that's different than saying they trust naturopathic medicine.
I think it's a good question, but to be honest, when I'm looking for a good endocrinologist in my area, you know, I'll take somebody out for lunch. I want to understand the person. I you know, they got this training and they went to this school and they're licensed by this thing and they have this specialty. I know they have the cred, but I want to know the person before I'm referring to them. So in fairness to those people referring to me, yes, I think it's who I am, but I think they also appreciate that I went to a reputable school. I passed a standardized board exam. It starts with individuals. It always does, whether we're talking about race relations, you know, or medical referrals. So I have also sent them the names of colleagues because the patient is in that area. Of course, a lot of people working via telemedicine due to COVID, and we'll continue, hopefully. And this integrative medicine, naturopathic medicine, oncology lends itself to telemedicine. So any of you listening to this podcast, if you don't live in a state where there are licensed naturopathic doctors or you live in a rural area, you're not close to that kind of services, many providers are able to work via telemedicine, which is wonderful. So, you know, I hope some of it's because of me, you know, it's like, but I see the double edge there we're getting at, Tina, and I appreciate that. We have so much to offer. Even an entry-level naturopathic doctor would have a lot to offer a cancer survivor or a cancer patient going through treatment.
Yeah.
And of course, you've mentioned this on the podcast, but there's the Oncology Association of Naturopathic Physicians, which is a specialty organization with additional training, additional testing, additional requirements. And anybody who has the designation FABNO after their ND, these are people that you can really know have studied this topic deeply and need a tremendous amount of continuing education, and you need a FABNO in your court.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know, because I lecture quite a bit in oncology, as you know, and when I'm lecturing to naturopathic physicians, I can feel the people who don't do a lot of cancer care are reticent, understandably, because they don't want to do any harm. And what's amazing is I would argue that some of the most basic pieces of just getting someone to feel as well as possible on a day-to-day, proper sleep, movement, keeping the bowels moving, you know, hydration, all these super simple things are actually impactful during treatment and afterwards. I mean, even if someone's not specialized, there's so much that can be done to help somebody from a functional perspective.
Right.
To help them function better on a day-to-day. And then, yeah, sure, if they're going through treatment, it's best to see somebody who's well-versed in that and knows what can and can't be done alongside various conventional treatments.
Definitely. Definitely. I would add to that list, looking at and some of the naturopathic doctors that are good at is looking at the toxins in your home, in your food that you're eating, in the personal care and cleaning products that you use. That's low-hanging fruit. You know, get rid of that stuff, slowly replace things with more natural stuff. And I love that you brought up, you know, ensuring daily bowel movements. And just us naturopathic doctors have a whole world. The field is around called the emunctories, which are the parts of the body that help us get rid of the natural metabolites, as well as external, more toxic things, including having bowel movements each day, good deep breathing, sweating as best we can, and a few other things. And that supporting the emunctories is just a very basic part of the naturopathic doctor toolkit.
I was going to ask, because I'm so curious, because when I went through treatment, you know, I had my own treatment plan from having worked in oncology for several years. And then I had my naturopathic doctor who at the cancer center where I was treated, who reined me in, you know. I had this like, I want to do all this. And then he kind of like was like, okay, maybe not. So like, if you look back on all of the things you did, what were the few things that you took or that you ate or whatever? Like, what would you say would be your desert island treatment plan?
Right. Well, I think this goes back a lot to remembering that many people going through treatment are tired. And so being able to do everything, whether it's shopping the organic section at the farmer's market, you know, or preparing healthy food or making time to exercise, those things fall off the what can I do today, you know, list due to fatigue, which I definitely experienced, particularly toward the end of my treatment when things were, you know, it's cumulative, as it should be. It's a big job to do these harsh treatments, cumulative. But I would say that probably the biggest changes that I made that I stayed with, and remember, I went into this already very healthy. And honestly, I found a lump in my breast. I felt perfect. The only time I never felt bad from cancer. I only ever felt bad from treatments for cancer, which I also understood were necessary for my survival. So it's a complicated metric. I was the kind of person who used to, I would eat dinner, you know, 7, 8 o'clock, maybe have a little snack at 9. Before bed. And then I would get up and I one foot on the floor, the other foot in front of the refrigerator for breakfast. And I had maybe a consistently speaking 9-hour overnight fast. And I did a lot of the reading around fasting mimicking diets and how those impacted immune function, particularly during chemo. So I worked to extend my overnight fast. And to this day, I'm now in that 15 to 16 hour a day overnight fast, which I find very easy because I got to it gradually. I didn't try to do it overnight. I got to it gradually. That was one big change. The other thing I started to do was I started to drink water. Sounds funny, but I am what I would consider a thirstless person. I am almost never thirsty, except if I'm working out. If I go for a run, you know, I am thirsty and I drink. But other than that, day to day, I don't have a coffee or tea habit. I'm just not that thirsty. So I have to remind myself, and I've gotten better at it. And as we were taught in school, the more you drink, the thirstier you will become. That is true to a point. I'm not the thirstiest person in the world. And then I had some very basic food sensitivity testing done, and I removed a number of foods that it turned out I was sensitive to. I didn't have any particular symptoms that made me think I had food sensitivities, but I also knew that food sensitivities can cause inflammation at some level. So I removed just a small number of foods. Thankfully, none of them were favorite foods. That was helpful. other than that, I had taken a small handful of supplements based on my family history my whole adult life. You know, besides the time when I was pregnant, where I took prenatals, I took these. My father died of a heart attack in his sleep at 48. So I was always mindful of that. I was taking fish oil. I was taking some anti-inflammatory things. Not a lot, just in the mornings. I upped my supplement game with direction and help from my naturopathic providers. And I think that was about, those are, that's about it. That's about what I changed. I added some special foods that we know have anti-cancer effect. I always loved mushrooms, but I made sure that I ate mushrooms almost every day. I definitely upped my berries. We know that berries have such high antioxidants. I like berries, but I wasn't eating them every day. I started eating berries most days, maybe in a smoothie or in some yogurt. And I also tended to, I'm not a big meat eater, but I felt like my blood counts really took a hit from chemo. So I started integrating more animal products into my diet. And, you know, the research on diets related to cancer is continuing and ongoing. It does seem that a more plant-based diet is probably better, but it's not better for everybody. And you have to take into account other underlying illnesses and reactions to treatment. But I did add that. And then the last thing that I added food-wise was I started having a couple of cups a day of green tea for whatever it was worth. I was also taking a green tea supplement. I would sometimes dilute that with pomegranate juice, you know, kind of double my money there. And then I shifted more attention to my microbiome. We know the microbiome is such a tremendous source of our immune capacity. Mm-hmm. I always had a terrific digestive system, so it wasn't for that. But I really started taking and switching up probiotics. I started eating more cultured and fermented foods to my, not a lot, you know, forksfuls and spoonfuls. You don't need like a whole bowl of sauerkraut. And that was fun to integrate things. I learned more about kimchi, which I'd never really had, the Korean condiment that there's 1,000 kinds of kimchi to taste and experiment with. Yeah. And I also did one thing that I share with patients, which is I gave myself the goal of eating 10 vegetables a day. And people are like, oh my God, that sounds like too many vegetables. But here's how you do it. You have one or two vegetables with your breakfast. For me, what that means is sometimes I just eat a carrot or a piece of celery. Other times I'll quick steam a handful of kale or spinach. And whatever else I'm having, whether it's granola and yogurt or eggs and a piece of toast or sometimes leftovers, I disconnected what is a breakfast food with breakfast. That was very helpful. And then I have one salad a day always. And in a salad, you can put 5, 6, 7 veggies. I love to grate carrots and beets and red cabbage, a little bit of lettuce, maybe some tomatoes and cucumbers. And there, I have 6 veggies there because research has shown increasingly that it's not only the amount of veggies, but it's the variety of veggies that we eat that can be helpful. So, and then I have 1 or 2 with dinner and I'm good to go.
Yeah, I think Heather Zwicky, who's an immunologist, has recently lectured and was indicating that some of the research is showing at least 30 different plant-based foods per day.
A week. Yeah, because I've been trying to do that.
A week.
Otherwise, you would do all day is you'd be a rabbit, basically.
Yeah. It was a week. Okay, a week.
Yeah, and it has to be different, which is I've been starting to teach my patients that. And it's harder than one thinks because we really get into this habit of like, you know, it's zucchini season. So it's zucchini everything, you know, and it's like trying to fit that one in that maybe you wouldn't normally eat, putting in that sweet potato or whatever it may be. I mean, I have been trying that and it's a lot harder than I thought it would be for somebody who eats a lot of, you know, I say plants. I'm going with plants all around. So yeah.
I also, the other thing that I share with patients is the beauty and relevance of frozen organic vegetables. You know, I will stock up when they go on sale at my local food co-op. I will stock up on frozen broccoli, frozen kale. And the reason I do it is not that I don't want fresh, but frozen is just about as good as fresh. And it's very quick. So if it's a day that I'm busy with patients, something with my kids, what have you, I can just literally steam in 30 seconds, no chopping, no cutting, no washing. You know, you just rinse out the pot and I have a big bowl of broccoli with my, you know, with my almond butter and honey sandwich. You know what I'm saying? So it's something that I can do quick, mm-hmm. which sometimes is the operative word.
And it's not going bad in the back of your fridge in the veggie bin.
Exactly. And we travel a lot, Paul and I travel a lot for teaching and for family stuff. We travel a lot. So I will have that in the fridge. So when I come home from a trip, I don't, you know, there's nothing. I have my frozen veggies in the freezer. Very helpful.
When you were in treatment, did you make use of things like acupuncture and Reiki or reflexology, massage, any of that?
I love a massage and I did get massage periodically. I did acupuncture a few times for specific complaints that arose. I developed a hematoma that was just terrible. That was probably the worst part of my cancer treatment was I developed a hematoma after a not very bad fall. I think my platelets were just that low. My blood counts were low. So I did some acupuncture then. I did find that although I generally love anything related to that, you know, energy medicine. I'm very easily influenced and I enjoy that. The idea of going to another thing, mm-hmm. I didn't have the energy. I didn't have the social energy to interact with a provider, if you will. So early on, after my double mastectomy, I had implants put on at the same time. It was very uncomfortable. That first couple of weeks, I had a lot of hands-on work, which was terrific. But after that, less so. I do more of that now as part of a maintenance thing. I try to get a massage every month. I love reflexology. You know, I'm just a glutton for all that stuff. So yeah, and you know, and research shows that those things are just quality of life can really help people. And I would say that many in-hospital cancer centers and also freestanding cancer support centers, we have a beautiful one in Northampton, Massachusetts, near where I live, called the Cancer Connection, offer many of these services for free to their providers. And some of these services, insurance, depending on your insurance, will cover, like massage and like acupuncture, chiropractic, osteopathic manipulations, et cetera. So I will feel that out, you know, no pun intended, with my patients. Some patients are very open to that, ask about it, want it. Other patients never heard of it, would never do that. And a lot of people somewhere in between.
Yeah, I remember a very poignant moment with a patient of mine. Her name was Linda, and she's getting an IV. And in talking to her, I put my hand on her arm, on her forearm. And she looked at me and she said, "No one ever touches me anymore." And she brought me to tears because I could feel how intense, like how important this was to her. And I thought, gosh, it's not something I really thought about. She didn't go home to somebody. She didn't have a partner at that time. And, you know, she just didn't have touch other than medical touch. And, you know, obviously I gave her a caring hand and she felt that. And it was kind of a profound moment for me to realize that that's something that I pay attention to with everybody all the time. All of my patients after that date, I kind of, you know, mentally went through, are they getting this and how open are they to getting a massage or reflexology or whatever? Because I think that touch is important.
Yeah, you bet. Even a haircut, you know, like a lot of people, because they lose their hair sometimes with chemo, but just something like that. I have a whole chapter in my book about physical touch and the various ways it can be received and sought out. I think it's a very key, we all need touch. It's part of the human condition. Some of us have been not been touched appropriately. So there could be a big trigger point, a little trauma around touch. So, you know, it's a little bit of a landmine, but it's certainly something to bring up. And of course, that is related also to intimacy. Many cancer survivors after treatment, even if they have very good prognoses and not a lot of big other kinds of side effects, have lower sex drive, less satisfaction with sex. Things don't work the same. And that's very common. It's often never talked about in the conventional oncology setting. The bigger oncology hospitals and centers now, some of them have separate sections for intimacy, sexuality, where people can go and really talk about that. And there are things to help in that realm. I have a whole chapter in the book on satisfaction and enjoyment from intimacy and sex. And I feel like it's an important thing to bring up if pertinent. If I have a person who that is asexual, you know, who just never is interested in that, obviously this is not their area of interest. But for a lot of people, it is part of something that they want to get back to, perhaps something that is part of their the normal, you know, I've got air quotes going here, normal things people do in life. And that can be, and some people have, you know, men a lot of times can no longer have an erection. Women have terrible vaginal dryness and getting irritated with intercourse. And there's, of course, many other ways people can be together. But having the conversation and, you know, and then here is the list of naturopathic approaches that we can use for fill in the blank kind of problems. So I did write about that with some depth in my book, because I feel like it's information people really want. They mm-hmm. really are interested. And especially younger and younger people, sadly, are getting cancer. So if somebody's 30 years old, you know, they have a whole life ahead of them. They don't want to not be able to enjoy intimacy.
Yeah.
And I think reframing intimacy is a really important part of it. And especially I've noticed with my male patients, you know, what their view of intimacy is and their partner's view can be very different. And they, like you were saying, like communication is so important because they may never have discussed that. One of my favorite things to prescribe to my male patients is ballroom dancing because it's so intimate. And it's, I mean, I don't even have to tell you, you ballroom dance. So.
I have to say, for most men in a heteronormative kind of situation, let's just say that, you know, are leaders in ballroom dance. They're not everywhere, and there's more openness to anybody can lead. But it's also terrifying to start. And I always, if you have a couple, you know, where one person wants to lead and one person is going to follow, I always recommend have the leader go for 3 or 4 months by themselves without the follower. They need to get a little bit, because it's much easier to follow. And so then the follower's like, what's wrong with you? You can't lead me. Believe me, it's I do both because I'm really a student of that world. And it's much harder to lead. And so we always talk about how ballroom dance can start out as this wonderful thing that couples try and do together and go directly from there to divorce court because they get so irritated with each other, you know. So let the leader go first for a few months. Just learn the concept of holding one's frame, learn the concept of lead and follow, learn the concept of like the music actually goes with the steps. It's a lot to take in. Mm-hmm. We can do a whole other session on ballroom dance on another podcast. I will say though, during treatment, I had done a year of ballroom when I was diagnosed. I have to say that my ballroom dance community was, I don't know if what was working better, the chemo or ballroom. I would literally go from one to the other and I would feel so good after getting off the dance floor. It was literally a very big gift and a big part of my healing.
That's awesome.
Because I would walk in and people would say to me, and I got really skinny. I lost my hair. I'm sure I was gray as a cloud, you know, and people would say, save a dance for me, or, oh, it's so good to see you. I can't wait to have a waltz with you later. As opposed to other settings, the grocery store or the park, people would come to me. Oh my God, I heard. I'm so sorry. You know, that right there was the difference between, you know, making me feel really bad and worse and making me feel like, okay, I'm going through this thing. Everybody goes through something. I'm going to get through it, you know? And mm-hmm. even if I don't, even if the outcome had been different, to still be seen as an individual and a person, as opposed to like a cancer person.
Right.
Well, Amy, we could talk all day to you. We could go chapter by chapter through your book. This has been awesome just chatting. So I know we're going to have you back in the future because it's just great to get your opinion. And I think that we've got a lot of useful information for the listeners in this episode.
Great. Love to.
So I'm excited to do these interviews with you and others in the future. So is there anything else, Leah, that we didn't cover that we should hit?
I don't think so. I mean, I am kind of curious about what kind of exercise you did during your treatment. I have kind of been working with other people at the hospital to institute a referral program for every patient to get some sort of exercise assessment, you know, training, because it is so important. And so,
yeah,
how is it for you?
Yeah, we know that exercise comes in three parts. We have aerobic exercise, we have resistance training or weightlifting, and then we have something sort of stretching. And I found that I tried to go for a walk every day. That was what I could do aerobically. I didn't do much more. Occasional bike ride in the better weather. I swam some when my white count was high enough. Didn't want to get in that cesspool of a, you know, town pool. But I tried to do some yoga or some stretching of some sort. I didn't do much resistance training. I worked a little bit with TheraBands because I was very interested in like not getting any issues related to the radiation side related to lymphedema. I thankfully didn't have lymphedema. It turned out that my sentinel nodes were quite central, kind of toward my sternum. So there was less, I think, possibility of lymphedema there. But I think that the LiveStrong program at YMCAs, many YMCAs across the country, is excellent. They do a fair job. You have to be cleared by your physician. But it's a wonderful group. It's cancer patients and survivors mixed together. And they'll take you through, and they'll have somebody follow you around and kind of gear it just to you. That's one model. I cannot say enough about how it made me feel like I was doing something normal, which is very important. Mm-hmm. And I think it helped the treatments work better. I mean, we know particularly with radiation, one of the best advice we give our patients for radiation is if you're better perfused, meaning the blood is moving around better, you will the radiation will work better. So I would walk for about 2 miles before I got on that cold metal table for my radiation treatments. And I was often sweating. My emunctories were working. I was sweating. And the people would say, are you okay? You have a fever? I'd be like, no, I just walked a couple of miles. And it also helps protect some of the underlying organs that you don't want to get radiated. So things like that, I think, are super important during treatment. And afterward, it is the number one. I will just say this. If somebody's going to do only one thing as a survivor, they should exercise. And if they're already exercising, they should uptick the amount and the variety of exercise they get.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, no, this has been, like you said, I mean, I could continue to listen to you and ask questions. And I mean, it's always interesting for me to meet another naturopathic physician who is a survivor because, it's
complicated. I mean, the main thing that people said to me when I told them that I had breast cancer, like friends, you know, they're like, you got breast cancer? I'm screwed, is what they said, because they knew my lifestyle. But I always will point out to patients, you know, across the board, bad things happen to good people. You know, people can do every single thing right. Nobody's getting out alive. I mean, you know, be perfectly honest, it is part of the contract of life. So we've got to make the best of what we do have. And there are opportunities everywhere to improve quality of life and impact health outcomes. So, yeah. Can I mention my book for a minute? Can I talk a little bit about my book?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is the perfect time.
Oh, yeah. We probably should give the title of the book and such. Yeah, we've mentioned it, you kind of, but we haven't talked.
Well, it's called You Finished Treatment, Now What? A Field Guide for Cancer Survivors. I did not self-publish. I have a wonderful publisher called Kohler Books, and it is launching on September 26, 2022. It is available in hardback, softback, audiobook, and ebook. And it is really just a kind of ride through a lot of different areas we've covered on this podcast and more. And there's a fair amount of me in the book because I really, I've been through it. And so I try to share that in a way that helps people understand. I also share patient stories in most of the chapters, so you can get a little bit of a sense of how doctors like Dr. Leia and Dr. Tina and I work with patients, just vignettes of patient stories. I also talk a little bit about translational medicine, where we know things are happening in the laboratory, that there is wonderful things coming down the pike. It takes a long time to get from there to the bedside, and just how to keep yourself as up to date as possible with clinical trials and things like that, which I think is important. I think it's a fun book, and it's absolutely beautiful. I love the way the publisher, the cover that they created is beautiful. And I hope a lot of people will read it. And if you're interested in having me come speak to a support group or a book group or be on your podcast, I am really trying to spread the word and the information in this book. It's a bit of a love letter to our profession, I would say. And I'd like to share it as widely as possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we'll put a link to it in our show notes for sure, so that people can link over and find the book easily. And I want to put a little plug in. You also did an audio, so it will be on Audible, right? .com.
Yes, it will be on Audible. The Audible, my sound engineer promises me it would be done by early fall. So yeah, in the next couple of months. And that is harder than it looks, reading a whole book aloud. There's a lot of words that we read and we write that are big, that we have no problem writing, but then when they just don't flow off the mouth just quite as easily as you think. But it was a fun exercise. And it was also the first time I had ever read a whole book out loud like that. And I could see the arc of the story in the book from the time of diagnosis and from the time of completing treatment all the way through where I am now, some many years later. And it's a good story. I think it's a good story.
Yeah, I can't wait for the full book. I've read some excerpts, but I'm jonesing for the whole thing.
Well, you can let me know what form you'd like it in, and I will be sending it to you. I don't know who's going to buy the hardcover. It's quite expensive, but some people already told me I want the hardcover. I'm like, okay, that's fine. But yes, I'd be happy to send you a copy, both of you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I would love to have more advice on how to get through this part of, you know, post-treatment. So, because I think there's always stuff to learn, you know?
Bet. The other thing that I, one vision I have for this book, somebody says to me, well, what do you want this book, you know, to do, or where do you want it to go? I said, I'd like every oncologist to have a stack of them in their office and just give them to their patients when they're done with treatment. Instead of, you know, like one of my doctors, when you finish your last radiation treatment, there was a bell there that you could ring to like celebrate the end. And I did it and I felt very weird about it. It was sort of like, I don't need a bell. I need like, what's the roadmap for now? You know, what are we doing now? And that's what this book is about. So you finished your treatment here. Have this book. You should read this. Go find yourself a naturopathic doctor, you know.
Yeah, I love the connotation of the book being a field guide, because it's exactly it. You're in this intense treatment. You're being seen a lot by doctors. And then when it's over, you literally walk out the door and that's it. Like, see you in a year.
You're kicked out of the nest, kind of a thing, you know?
Yeah.
And you're saying this, Leah, and you're a naturopathic doctor. So imagine people who don't have any of that background or training. Yeah, it's like it's people are feel exalted for like 10 minutes and then they feel like, oh, now what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, thank you so much for having me. It's really been fun.
Oh, thank you for making time to talk to us. This has been great.
You bet.
I think we all survived our first interview. Ours, not yours, Amy or Tina. It's mine. I've never interviewed anyone. So this has been a lot of fun.
Yes. Thank you so much, Amy. It's been a good time and a lot of great information. And I think it's one that people probably can listen to more than once, is my guess, because there was jam-packed with all sorts of good tips and helpful advice. So thank you.
Awesome. All right. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
See you.
That was a lot of fun. This was my first time ever talking with Dr. Rothenberg. So I think I'm going to like these interviews, Tina.
I think you're going to really like the interviews, because I'll be honest. I mean, okay, so here's the thing. You've got like at least 12 BFFs out there. So I know you know how to talk to people and chat and be a good conversationalist. I've known you for long enough to know that. So to me, I was like, if we do interviews, we could talk to people who know stuff, whether it's a nutritionist, an acupuncturist or whatever. And all we have to be is inquisitive and have a conversation. And we get to talk to a real expert.
Yeah, we could go into a conversation not knowing anything and just ask a bunch of questions. No, this is good.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a win-win. It's less work for us, but it's also straight to somebody who's an expert in something. So that's best for the listener anyway.
Okay, let's wrap it up. So we've got more interviews coming in this pod series. And then I guess in this new season. And if you like what you hear, send us a note if there's anyone you want us to talk to. I know we've gotten a lot of people requesting to be on the podcast. And so now that we're starting to do interviews, we can start reaching out. Rate and review, listen, buy us coffee, all that stuff that we always say at the end of the episode.
That's right. Give us feedback, you know, reach out to us. We are at The Cancer Pod everywhere. TheCancerPod.com, at The Cancer Pod on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. So
Gmail.
Just send us a note. And yeah, we'll keep doing what we're doing as long as it's helping people out. And a little shout out doesn't hurt. Do pass it on to friends and loved ones that you want to help out. I think that's really useful, because that is the goal here, is to help people. And so share this if you are so inclined.
Yeah. On that note, I'm Dr. Leah Sherman.
And I'm Dr. Tina Kayser.
And this is The Cancer Pod.
Until next time.
Thanks for listening to The Cancer Pod. Remember to subscribe, review, and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on social media for updates. And as always, this is not medical advice. These are our opinions. Talk to your doctor before changing anything related to your treatment plan. The Cancer Pod is hosted by me, Dr. Leah Sherman, and by Dr. Tina Kayser. Music is by Kevin MacLeod. See you next time.
Okay, cool.